Welcome to today's episode of the Ideonomics podcast, where we talk about inclusion, diversity, equity, accessibility, and anti-racism in the Canadian Public Service. I'm your co-host, Neha Shahzad Chandrarajan, joining you from Ottawa, which is the land of the unceded and unsurrendered territory of the Algonquin Anishinaabe peoples.
And I'm your co-host for today, Vishala Shebidesi. I work at the CBSA as the Culture Ambassador for the Commercial and Trade Branch. I'm also an executive member of the Women's Advisory Committee, the Racialized Persons Advisory Committee, and the Branch EDI Steering Committee. I'm located in the city now known as Toronto, which is the traditional unceded territory of many nations, including the Mississaugas of the Credit, the Anishinaabeg, the Chippewa, the Haudenosaunee, and the Wendat peoples, and is now home to many diverse First Nations, Inuit, and Métis peoples. Welcome to part two of our conversation with author, historian, and professor Dr. Blair L. M. Kelly. In part one, we learned about a few of the historical figures in the book Black Folk, The Roots of the Black Working Class, and highlighted some of Blair's family members that are featured in the book. We also discussed the dynamic of a historian writing about their own family history and how Blair approached it, along with how her family members responded to her research on her family's history. In this episode, we talk about the working class. We discuss the history of Black workers' unions, washerwomen, and how the issues with the current working class compare us from a historical perspective. Welcome to part two of our conversation with author, historian, and professor Dr. Blair L. M. Kelly. Let's get right back into it. Blair, I'd like to find out more about the Pullman Porter's first all-Black private union that you mentioned in part one of our conversation. You said it was formed as a result of being denied membership in the all-white railway workers' union. Was this essentially the start of Black unions in the United States?
I've traced Black unions and Black union organizing back to the first moments of freedom. And so Black workers are interested in unionism from the very start. For the postal unions, for example, they're trying to join when they're finally allowed to do postal work. But again, you know, there's a constant kind of rejection from white unions that they form their own organizations over and over again.
I typically tend to be really interested in women's stories. I find a lot of hidden, powerful figures come from our women. So I'm really curious about your washerwoman, Sarah Hill, like why she was interviewed, why did she gain so much attention? And I guess the role of washerwomen in general.
So the WPA was interviewing mostly formerly enslaved people. That was their main focus. But there was also an interest in iconic kinds of professions. You know, she's interviewed in the 1930s. Washerwomen are sort of on the wane. Their washing machines are starting to come into fore, and at least the mechanisms, you know, wringers and things that agitate, you know, off the side of your tub or like, you know, bring the water out. So those kinds of inventions are more ubiquitous. And so washerwomen are on decline. By the 1950s, you know, most of them are gone because of the advent of the washing machine and for in-home use with appliances and things like that. I think they were seeking out someone who had done that work to interview and to show that quote-unquote authentic version of what a washerwoman was. So the woman that interviewed her was very focused on stereotyping her, you know, talking about how Black she looked and the turban on her head, quote-unquote. And there's a lot of minstrelsy around washerwomen and washerwomen's children and soap and all that stuff. So I trace all that in the chapter because I think that we've forgotten the degree to which that was a big part of the culture. There were even wedding showers that were washerwoman themed, where people would put on blackface and give the bride her new sheets dressed as washerwomen. I saw one in the newspaper and I was like, what the heck? Oh my gosh, it was like a trend. So that's how culturally insensitive people were about Black women doing this work. And yet there was the real life with her life. So I wanted to go back and do the census work and recreate her neighborhood, the church where she got married. I found her wedding documents. I found all kinds of really amazing things in the historical record about her and the things that she didn't share in the interview. And so I rewrite the story from both women's positions, both the interviewer's position, sort of looking at her and judging her. And then I write it from Sarah's perspective about who she really was.
That's interesting to know about the stereotyping. And I certainly did not know about this bridal shower.
Breaking news on that one. I think I did that. I think that's been forgotten. And now I've brought it back. The article was like, we had a wonderful bridal shower and just describes, you know, all the fun that they had and the snacks and then the men putting on the blackface and giving the sheets and everyone was delighted. That's what the art, you know, updates from someone's bridal shower.
Like an Instagram post.
Yes. And newspapers back in the day would announce people who came to visit or had a shower or their wedding or, you know, any basic, had a baby.
Yeah.
And so it's just a lug and those kinds of the basic announcements they were describing. Yeah, how much fun they had. But I mean, it was telling. It was really interesting in telling, you know, people's perceptions and the jokes they wanted to make about washerwomen. But I posit that they're making fun of washerwomen because they're powerful. They really are independent and they don't work in white households. They stay away. They work in their own yard. They raise their own kids. They set their own schedule. And they're the first Black women after the Great Emancipation in 1865 to organize a union. So there's a union of washerwomen in Jackson, Mississippi, who in 1865 set demands on pay and schedule and where they'll do their work. And so for me, it's about the resistance that makes them a target for being mocked because they want to weaken them as a people.
I love that angle. The fact that they're powerful, that power makes a lot of money.
Not a lot of money, but their independence and their mobility is powerful.
Mm-hmm. And then so when Sarah was featured then in that article, and you were talking about the authentic washerwoman experience, was that sort of in fear of new laundry technologies, should I say?
I don't think it was like about technology. I think it was sort of like, you know, a romantic version. Uh-huh. Like, you know, here's like the old life that we used to have. The whole interview is called Be the Washerwoman, which is not her name. You know, I think that's sort of making someone anonymous and doesn't matter what her real name is. But I was worried about finding her in the census document because, you know, her name is Sarah Hill. So it's not like a outstandingly unique name. But I found her. She was the first person that came up when I typed her name in and where she was from. Really seeing, you know, her own family and working independently as a washerwoman for her whole life was really incredible, too.
That is incredible. Because as you said, they didn't make much money.
No, absolutely not. But they had their independence and they could raise their own children, which was really stood in contrast to an enslavement where, you know, children were taken or women were forced to just set them somewhere and under trees and you know, let other small children care for babies. So washerwomen were so attracted to that position because of family and because of their ability to care for their own.
As the title says, your book focuses on the Black working class. From a historical context, are there any comparisons you can draw? I've seen a lot of things happening, especially at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. There became this huge disparity again between office workers who could stay at home and work versus the, quote, essential workers that did not have that option. They had to go out there and put their lives at risk to work so they could provide for themselves and their families. In your opinion, did you see history repeating itself?
Yeah, I was drawn to exactly what you're talking about and thinking about, you know, the language of essential workers and the folks who never had the privilege of going home and, you know, staying safe from COVID. There's a crew of women that I am friends with from my church community who are there. I never had a day off. Like I'm a postal worker. I'm a CNA. I'm a nurse. I work in the hospital. You know, they didn't have a break. And they didn't have the knowledge or the ability to even stay safe. What were the best ways to avoid getting sick? And the degree to which, you know, Black workers were vulnerable in those very early days was really incredible. And so it was something, of course, I thought about as I was writing the book in the midst of the pandemic, because those worker questions came right to the fore. But the same kinds of networks that people used in the past really supported Black workers in that moment. And I also think it caused a sort of reckoning with, you know, the meaning of work and people pushing for better pay, people resigning from jobs that are just completely thankless. And people organizing, unions and union efforts across the country, really get reamplified during this time period. And I don't think it's any accident that, you know, the Black workers are in a lot of those efforts to rethink what we accept and what we should strive for in terms of workers' rights.
Well, Blair, this has been a fascinating conversation. I feel like but I'm afraid of keeping you from your very important work also. But I just want to thank you so much for coming and diving so deep into these stories. It's been really eye-opening for me, and I'm sure for Shala as well. So I just want to say thank you so much. And for our listeners, you can get Blair's book, Black Folk, The Roots of the Black Working Class, on Amazon.ca or on Indigo.ca as well, or anywhere else that you buy your books. So thank you so much, Blair.
Thanks for having me. It's been great.
Yes, Blair, thank you so much for spending this time with us. It really was an honor to speak with you and to hear about your family's history and your research. I look forward to picking up a copy of your book. To our podcast listeners, thank you for tuning in to part two of our conversation with Dr. Blair L. M. Kelly. As a reminder, in case you missed part one, you can find it on episode 13 of the Ideanomics podcast. I hope you'll join us again for our next episode.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Ideanomics podcast. We hope it was enjoyable for you, as it was for us. For more anti-racism news, please follow us on our social media channels on Twitter, @IranNetwork_PS, and our LinkedIn, Anti-Racism Ambassadors Network.
If you would like us to discuss any topics on the podcast, or if you have any questions, please DM us on our social channels or email us at aran.publicservants@gmail.com.
This episode was hosted by Neha Shahzad Chandarajan and Vishala Shambidesi. This episode was also edited by Vishala Shambidesi.